Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In certain circles, it is one of the most infamous moments in American political history. Not Dewey beats Truman, not Nixon's resignation, but the day when Democratic nominee Michael Dukakis, clearly hoping to look strong enough to be commander-in-chief, tooled around a grassy field from the open top of a tank in a helmet roughly three sizes too big. The year was 1988, the same year the presidency went to George H.W. Bush. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. In hindsight, it is glaringly obvious that a stunt like that was destined to backfire. But in the moment, it was not so clear that Dukakis was hand-delivering the very images his opponent would use to eviscerate his campaign in a withering TV ad. So it goes, my guest will explain, in what he calls the age of optics. Josh King is former director of production for presidential events at the White House, co-creator and former host of the satellite radio show Polyoptics. His new book is called Off Script, An Advanced Man's Guide to White House Stagecraft, Campaign Spectacle, and Political Suicide. Josh, welcome to Think.
Such a pleasure to be with you, Chris.
What does an advanced man or an advanced woman, there are some, do?
And, there are.
And where does one fall in the hierarchy of campaign and administrative staff? How much power does an advanced man have?
Well, they don't really operate in headquarters. They're more dispatched out into the field. So their penetration into campaign hierarchy doesn't really happen usually until candidate is elected president, and then a White House establishes its own advance office. And then you see advance people being a regular presence in the White House, where basically the president does his, maybe in the future, her events basically in the backyard a lot of times. But an advance person in a campaign are sort of the movie producers of politics. They create the tableau, the scene, all the actors who are on stage with the main character who's the candidate. The only thing that they don't control, really, are the cameras and then the editing and distribution. So they do the best that they can to create this shot, a wide shot, a medium shot, and a close-up shot, and then leave it to the traveling press corps or the local press, if it's an event in Dallas, for instance, to shoot it head-on and then to shoot reverse shots. And these are the shots that Donald Trump, over the last year, has been railing against the reporters. I want to see more of the crowds, because he's been a great student of political iconography, political stagecraft, and he wanted it more for himself. So that's what advanced people do. It depends on the candidate, how proficient they are in the stump about creating a great moment, about attracting large crowds. Members of the advanced team are crowd builders as well. They try and get as many people as they can out to an event. We did many in Fort Worth with President Clinton, tried to fill up, Pioneer Square. But that's what we do.
There are people, as you know, outside politics who find it a little bit distasteful that such a position exists. I wonder if you have come to a conclusion as to why people are not bothered by the fact that people write speeches for presidents and people sort of perform other functions that will make them sound good. But the idea of having someone to make them look good is troubling to people.
Yeah, and it's something I plead guilty to readily. I'm not sure, Chris, what came first, but I think it was the winnowing down of time devoted to coverage of candidates by the vehicle that they needed most, which was television. And so if you go back way to the beginning of packaged news, let's call it 80, 84, and then to 88, where my book picks up, you get, if you're lucky, 2 minutes of airtime, at that time reported by Sam Donaldson, Chris Wallace, or Bruce Morton. And what they were looking for, what they demanded of candidates, was content, was B-roll, was color, the types of momentary imagery that would be attached to their narration and the editor's production of these two-minute packages that were then put on by Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, and Dan Rather. So it really is a chicken and egg thing. And I say at the end of the book how wonderful it was to have Barack Obama on an hour-long podcast with Mark Maron on WTF. But Americans' attention span and the means of distribution of their events doesn't lend itself to that. So they rely on people like Advance People to create enough imagery in a visit to Texas, for example, to feed the interest of the morning news, the local affiliates, and the national reporters that follow.
Josh, by your calculations, the age of optics began with that ill-conceived Dukakis tank ride in 1988. Why that moment and not, say, the 1960 Nixon-Kennedy debate when Kennedy was judged the winner by those who saw it on TV and Nixon by those who heard the contest on radio?
Right. And so I had to pick some spot, Chris. And I talk about a lot of the debates beginning in 1960 from the very beginning of my book. I talk about Al Gore and sighing on camera. I talk about George H.W. Bush looking at his watch. I have to say that I have to put aside these debate moments because they're not things that were actually manufactured so much by candidates or staffs to feed this this media appetite. So it's I go to 88 because that was the campaign where, number one, you had an open White House, George H.W. Bush, the vice president, Mike Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts, vying for an open Oval Office. Media had advanced well past film and into videotape. They were into much more storytelling through these stops at different places on the political hustings. And 88, specifically the September 13th visit to the Sterling Heights Land Systems facility on September 13th, really marked the first time that I could think of that a moment manufactured by a campaign became backfired so miserably, both in the free media news cycle the week that followed, and then 5 weeks later when it was turned into a devastating TV ad. The very actions of one candidate contorted by their opponent in a paid ad that made them look very bad and affected them for the rest of the campaign.
You were working for the Dukakis campaign when all this went down. How did the idea come about? What was the idea? What did you want to accomplish, your team, by putting Michael Dukakis in a military tank?
Well, to be clear, Chris, I think in 88 I was 23 years old or 24.
What did your bosses want to accomplish?
Well, what did my first campaign? And I just did what I was told. But it was a long time in coming. Governor Dukakis, like me, graduated from Swarthmore College in 1957, I believe, or well before that, actually, maybe 57. And he was drafted into the Army, spent 2 years in Korea during the armistice. And that was the sum and substance of his military experience. By contrast, George H.W. Bush, then the vice president, had already been one of the youngest fighter pilots in World War II, shot down over the Pacific, plucked up by the USS Finback, a congressman from your state, and then CIA director, National Party chairman, and envoy to China. So if the two campaigns, where Dukakis actually had an advantage going into the spring and summer of 1988, looked at Dukakis' own weaknesses, it would be, could he be a credible commander-in-chief? He polled very well on things like cares about us, but probably 4-1 against whether he would be a better commander-in-chief than H.W. Bush. And so throughout the summer of 88, they started crafting more events that put him in a quasi-military setting, sent him back to his old barracks at Fort Dix. And then they came up with the idea to have National Defense Week that week of September 10th through 14th. And sent him to Philadelphia and then to Cincinnati and Chicago, ultimately to Washington, D.C. But between Chicago and Washington, a stop at the M1A1 Abrams main battle tank facility at General Dynamics Land Systems. The question is, can we put Governor Dukakis in for a tank ride and create that image of him, maybe if they were thinking in the back of their minds like Patton? They had seen that movie and they wanted to see if they could recreate that for the cameras that were watching.
Among the problems, and it shouldn't matter, but it did, was the fact that Governor Dukakis was probably 6 inches shorter than George C. Scott.
Yeah, and the M1A1 tank was a whole lot bigger than the M60 Sherman tank that Scott rode in on the movie. And when you are Franklin W. Schaffner, the cinematographer of Patton, you control all the angles that you're going to shoot him from. Scott, who won the Best Actor Award, the Oscar that year for his portrayal of Patton, certainly wasn't going to be portrayed in any unflattering light. But when you are an official at General Dynamics and Governor Dukakis wants to ride in your 60,000-pound deadly vehicle, you don't want the responsibility of any accident befalling the Democratic presidential nominee. So you tell him and his staff that you need to wear a helmet while you're riding around at 45 miles an hour, making very fast U-turns. And that helmet both serves as your protection, because we know so sadly how many people have been injured by IUDs in Iraq when something happens and they're exposed. And also for communications. Gordon England was the head of Land Systems at the time, a Fort Worth guy working on the F-16 project for General Dynamics. They sent him up to Land Systems to run it, and Gordon, who then became Secretary of the Navy, was essentially Dukakis' wingman as they took this ride around in the tank.
So there was debate on the staff over whether he should wear that helmet, despite the recommendations that he do so. And this, you know, is something that has gone down. It's legendary, right? Barack Obama has said on camera, presidents don't put things on their heads. You know, candidates don't put things on their heads. Why was the helmet such a deal breaker in terms of the optics of that video?
Well, I tell the story at the beginning of the book of President Obama in 2013 in the East Room, welcoming the Navy midshipmen of Annapolis to receive the Commander-in-Chief's trophy. It's one of the great things that a president can do. I worked in the White House for many years, and whether it's the Stanley Cup champions or the Super Bowl champion Dallas Cowboys or Olympic champions, one of the most wonderful thing a president can do is welcome these victorious teams in. And in exchange for that hospitality, the captains of the team will usually bestow a token of the winning campaign. And in this case, in 2013, it was a helmet from Navy, tricked out with the anchor and chain and the number 44 for Dukakis' place in the numerical pantheon of U.S. leaders.
Obama's place, excuse
and,
for
Obama's place. And Obama takes the helmet in his hand, and he looks lovingly at it. He looks at it from all sides. And you can hear, as you watch the video, murmurs from the crowd saying, put it on, let's see you in the helmet. And he sort of pauses, and he goes back to the microphone. He says, well, here's the general rule. I call it Politics 101. Never put anything on your head if you're president. Presidents never look good doing that. And that was obviously a reference to September 13th, 1988, Dukakis putting that helmet on his head. Matt Bennett was the advance person in Sterling Heights, made repeated calls back to his headquarters in Boston. Please reconsider this. He's going to look stupid. And they tried to devise a scheme where during the tank ride, the tank would stay far away from the press riser and then only do one slow motion pass in front of the cameras in which Governor Dukakis wasn't wearing the helmet. But something went wrong during the choreography of the ride. And as they finished the ride with Dukakis wearing the helmet, it came extremely close to the riser, almost decapitating the videographers with the 105-millimeter cannon as it pivoted to the left. And that was the money shot. And that footage that night was seen by a guy in Washington, D.C. named Sig Rogish. Rogish was a media advisor for Ronald Reagan in 1984 and was running the advertising team under Roger Ailes in 1988. He said, I've got an idea. And that night, taking out a yellow legal pad, he wrote out the ad that would eventually become the tank ad. And it didn't see the light of day until 5 weeks later, the third game of the World Series. But when it did, and the Bush-Quayle campaign used so much of their advertising budget on it, it remained a piece of history from that point forward.
My guest is Josh King, former director of production for presidential events at the White House and co-creator and former host of the satellite radio show Polyoptics. His new book is called Off Script, An Advance Man's Guide to White House Stagecraft, Campaign Spectacle, and Political Suicide. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Josh King, former director of production for presidential events in the Clinton White House, author of the book Off Script, An Advance Man's Guide to White House Stagecraft, Campaign Spectacle, and Political Suicide. You can join us by finding me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Josh, once someone has been elected president, what kinds of choices are made by a president's advance team in causing that individual to look presidential?
Well, Chris, it's mostly the scene that they have to work with. Call it the sound studio of the presidency, which is the 18 acres of the White House grounds at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Remember, you've just come through 18 months of going to the Iowa pork producer's tent at the Iowa State Fair. You've trudged down to the border at El Paso, which you know. I mean, all these sort of rough and ready settings that become part and parcel of what you do as a presidential candidate. And then you make that journey up to Washington, D.C., spend your inaugural night as a resident of that town in Blair House, and the next morning you're making a speech on the west front of the Capitol of the United States with a gorgeous blue carpet as your backdrop and members of the House and Senate to your left and right flank. Then you get in that limousine and you go down Pennsylvania Avenue. You alight from the car. You walk among the adoring crowds for a little bit as the photographers get these pictures of you and your spouse waving, maybe your kids too if they're there. And then you sit in the reviewing stand. And then to finish up the day, you walk into what is your new home for the next 4 or 8 years. And that has places called the East Room, the Cross Hall, the Rose Garden, the South Lawn, the Oval Office. You don't have a better setting than that to confer upon you the imagery of the president. So a lot of the tactics and tools and processes of an advanced person become very much the same, but suddenly you have the conference of power by things like Air Force One, Marine One, your limousine, and a very different image comes across than you flipping pancakes or eating sausages at the pork producer's tent.
So there is a certain bearing, a certain gravitas that we expect of the commander-in-chief. But for 230 years, we have also associated being presidential with being male. Does that mean that a candidate like Hillary Clinton or any other woman who might run for president has a longer road to walk than one of her male colleagues?
It's a great question, and we'll see that test this summer. We haven't had a presidential candidate who's female, who's got close to the nomination before. We will now. I worked for Secretary Clinton and her husband in the White House for many years, have great respect for her, think that the country is greatly positioned to have a person of her experience so close to the presidency. But she has a very large wall to get over, and his name is Donald Trump, and he wants to put that wall up by the border. And so I think that you can have people who are good performers on the stump, and Secretary Clinton's husband was the best. She is more of a executive and a governor and an administrator than she is a candidate or a self-promoter. Some of the things she does on the campaign trail aren't as engaging or folksy as her husband. I don't think it's about gender, although Donald Trump is certainly using gender to try and brand her, just like he tried to brand Lion Ted, Little Marco, and Low Energy Jeb. It's for Donald Trump, it's not about gender. It's about how effectively can I brand to my own base. But Secretary Clinton has a perfect chance to show that it doesn't matter at all your gender. What I point out in the book, Chris, is that what we have had over the last three presidents we've elected, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, ages 46, 54, and 47, if I'm correct. And so I did say that if Secretary Clinton were to be paired or matched against someone of a younger age, precedent and experience so far has shown that we tend to elect these people in their late 40s and early 50s. But Secretary Clinton is 68, Donald Trump is 69, so age will not be a factor this summer if that's the matchup.
Given how unbridled the conflict has been in this election cycle, it's interesting to think back to the campaign of former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. He was polling well throughout the summer of 2003 and had an early hold on using the internet effectively, which a lot of people thought would propel him forward. And then in the fall of 2003, this happened.
You know something? Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Harkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
Okay, Josh King, there's more to the story than what we hear there. Some of the fault may have been with the folks setting him up on that stage.
Oh, Chris, it's such an unfortunate day for Governor Dean and his advance team. Now, settle in, because this will get a little technical.
Okay.
Governor Dean was at a place called the Valera Ballroom in West Des Moines. This is caucus night. He has been leading the campaign, had been expected to win the caucus and cruise forward in the following primaries and caucuses, but he comes in third. His staff, many of whom have flocked to Iowa, are so energetic and so full of hope, and they want the campaign to go on and succeed. And Governor Dean is told by his campaign manager, Joe Trippi, to really light up the crowd, to get them going. But just like you and I are in this studio and we're looking at one microphone and it's going through a soundboard and getting transmitted out to listeners just to project our voice very cleanly and crisply, the same was true for Governor Dean that night at the Valair, where there were 3,500 people in the room but only one microphone that was picking up the sound. And Governor Dean didn't have what we call return monitors, big speakers on stage to blow his own sound back into his face so that he knew how he was projecting to this large crowd. And when you hear him screaming, he can hardly hear himself speak. He's just trying to get his voice out to his supporters in that room. And yet when you're an anchor person or a producer back in New York or Washington watching this event happen live, all you're hearing is this one guy's voice elevated so highly, screaming, and you're saying, this guy is deranged. And that's what took hold that week and in the weeks following, and Howard Dean has never lived it down, really, for 16 years that have followed. And that event was the responsibility of a then-young man named Bo Willimon, a press advance person working on the Dean campaign. And those of us who watch TV with regularity know that it didn't really destroy Bo Willimon's career. He went on to become the creator and executive producer and showrunner of a little hit series on Netflix called House of Cards,
in which the main characters are really, 99% composed of illusion.
That's right. I mean, I begin the book with a moment in which President Frank Underwood and Jackie Sharp are in a debate in Iowa, and they're having it out, just like all the debates that we've watched over the past year. And everything about that scene is fake. Fake candidates, fake caucus goers, fake backdrop, fake questions. The only thing that's real in that whole thing, Chris, are the correspondents who've agreed to play themselves on their TV show. So we continue to watch what happens to Frank and Claire Underwood this season, but what they've shown themselves with Bo Willimon as the writer of so many of these episodes is so attuned to the fact that everything outside of their own bubble is an illusion.
I want to talk about what an advance team and the other people who are working on presidential marketing, for lack of a better word, imagery, can do after a mistake. We're going to play two bits of tape here, one after the other. We'll hear Barack Obama in 2008, followed by Mitt Romney in 2012, and I imagine you can guess what these clips are going to be, but let's hear them.
When you go into some of these small towns in Pennsylvania, a lot of small towns in the Midwest, The jobs have been gone now for 25 years, and nothing's replaced them. And they've gone through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and each successive administration has said that somehow these communities are going to regenerate, and they have not. So it's not surprising then that they get better and they cling to guns or religion or antipathy towards people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or, anti-trade sentiment. A way to explain their frustrations.
There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But it's an entitlement, and government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what. And the president starts off with 48, 49, 43. He starts off with a huge number. These are people who pay no income tax. 47% of Americans pay no income tax. So our message of low taxes doesn't connect. And he'll be out there talking about tax cuts for the rich. I mean, that's what they sell every 4 years.
Josh King, there is never a moment for a modern politician to assume he or she might not be recorded.
I'm glad you played extended cuts of those quotes, Chris, because they're fascinating. The first is a fundraiser on April 6, 2008, in San Francisco, California, that Senator Obama was attending. And the second was another fundraiser in Florida that Governor Mitt Romney was attending in 2012. And both of those events were surreptitiously recorded. Mayhill Fowler made the recording of Senator Obama and I can't remember his name, but a member of the wait staff at the person's home that Governor Romney was giving his remarks to made them and then subsequently leaked them to Mother Jones magazine. And both of these things, both of these events created huge problems for the candidate. It may have probably extended the primary season of Senator Obama and Senator Clinton in 2008 because the Pennsylvania primary was following and then Senator Clinton had considerable late success in the primary season. Governor Romney, the 47% video as it became known, was a perfect branding for what the Obama campaign was trying to associate Governor Romney with, which they had already done quite successfully earlier in that summer with an ad called Firms, which featured Governor Romney singing America the Beautiful, but set to images of closed up factories and empty boardrooms and Swiss bank accounts. And so one of the new tasks of an advance person, and I don't do advance anymore, Chris, but the people who do it tell me that one of the thankless and unfortunate things they have to do at most of these closed-door events now is confiscate everybody's cell phone as they come in.
Seriously?
Because,
really?
Oh, seriously, yeah. There are baskets in front of a beautiful home when you walk into a 2,700-a-person fundraiser where you are asked to deposit your device until after the event, you can pick it up on your way home because they don't want these kinds of surreptitious recordings spoiling the candidate's open press messages on the stump. And so you heard Barack Obama's shortened quote, which you had a longer part of, was largely taken out of context and wagged in his face, as was Governor Romney's. It's a perfect juxtaposition of what happens when the reality of campaigning and raising money brings you behind closed doors. And Governor Romney has said this himself, or Stuart Stevens, who was Romney's advisor, said, Governor Romney too often wants to play the political consultant, political analyst, and share with people how it's really going and analyze the things he's doing right, the things he's doing wrong for the people who have kindly written very large checks to him and the Republican Party. And the message, the lesson, unfortunately, to these candidates is you shouldn't do it. Assume the microphone is always on, because these two examples are perfect examples of how it'll come back to bite you in public.
So if those two things were essentially identical mistakes from opposite sides of the political spectrum, What would you say about, you know, the much laughed at, much derided effort that President George H.W. Bush made to use a supermarket scanner to buy a few items, and then the recent situation with Secretary Clinton trying to get on the subway like everybody else and discovering that she didn't know the special trick you have to know to get your card to work?
Two very different examples. That I write about, I wrote about the supermarket scanner incident in the book, and because the swiping incident happened very recently, there's a piece that I posted in Fortune magazine about that. But Vice President, or then at that time President Bush, January 1992, running for re-election, you know, if you'd visited with him in Kennebunkport, Maine a year earlier in 1991, and you'd seen the look on his and Barbara Bush's face as they sort of waded through the detritus of their home, ravaged by the hurricane, the perfect storm hurricane that devastated their home in Walker's Point, you would have felt that they were just like every other American to whom disaster sometimes befalls you, just trying to roll up your sleeves, put on work gloves, and wipe yourself off after a terrible calamity. We've seen in John Meacham's book about President Bush, you know, how much he was a loving and caring father and a great public servant, but yeah, he had communications challenges, and there was a narrative about him that was forming with Newsweek's cover story of Bush the wimp factor, and people who traveled with him, the White House press corps, were looking for visual moments to ascribe to that idea, to confirm that idea, and so in January of 92. After he gives a State of the Union address, just trying to make an economic plan, sell an economic plan to the American people, he goes down to the National Grocers Association convention in Orlando, Florida, and does what any candidate politician would do when you're being hosted by a gracious host. You show that you're interested in what they have to say and what they're doing. So before his speech, he goes for a walk through the exhibit hall, and there's the NCR exhibit. And he has the one reporter with him writes that he has a look of wonder on his face. And the next day, the front page of the New York Times says, Bush confronts the supermarket amazed.
Josh King is my guest. He's former director of production for presidential events at the White House and co-creator and former host of Polyoptics. It's a satellite radio show. His new book is called Off Script, An Advance Man's Guide to White House Stagecraft, Campaign Spectacle, and Political Suicide. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd speaking with Josh King, a former director of production for presidential events at the White House, author of the new book Off Script, An Advance Man's Guide to White House Stagecraft, Campaign Spectacle, and Political Suicide. So, Josh, how is the perhaps misinterpreted report about President George H.W. Bush looking with wonder on a modern supermarket scanner so different from Secretary Clinton's fumbling of the card at the subway turnstile?
Well, President Bush was really just going down to give a speech to the National Grocers Association. He was only seen by one reporter doing this that fed the rest of the reports, what we call the press pool. And Greg McDonald was the pool reporter that day and fed that story to the rest of the White House press corps. And Andrew Rosenthal wrote the story for the front page of the New York Times. Secretary Clinton, now in 2016, is in the middle of the New York media maelstrom, goes to the 161st Street subway station up in the Bronx, is going just on a two-stop photo op up to a interview with the Today Show's Matt Lauer, And whereas there was such a small, so few witnesses to what Secretary Clinton did, there was anyone with a cell phone on that subway platform could be a modern day Abraham Zapruder seeing what's happening on Dealey Plaza. Now, the difference is, Chris, is that in 1992, excuse me, there was only three broadcast networks. There was the New York Times, the Washington Post. USA Today was only 8 years old at that point. So something that and Johnny Carson and maybe David Letterman. And so something that happened that was highly remarked upon, comedic, or a point for ridicule had much longer staying power. Secretary Clinton was on her way to a convincing win in the New York primary. She hasn't sewn up the nomination or really distanced herself completely from Bernie Sanders yet. But that momentary pushing your subway card with that certain je ne sais quoi that will let you through the turnstile that she didn't seem to have, it was funny for a few hours. Even Secretary Clinton began to make jokes about it, even within what we call the same news cycle, somewhat disarming the criticism. I wrote about it because I could. But, you know, it's not seen as something that that stuck with her, because with the age of optics now having YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram all coming on since the 2004 campaign, anything funny, mishaps, snafus that seem to happen in one cycle are replaced within hours or even days by Ted Cruz talking out about a basketball ring or John Kasich eating pizza voraciously with a knife and fork that Donald Trump picks up on. So we haven't seen, I think with the exception of Senator Rubio and that disastrous debate performance in New Hampshire, something that a candidate does in public as having a whole lot of staying power in this new later period of the age of optics.
What do you know about Donald Trump's advance team?
Not a whole lot yet. I've been trying to always trying to get to some of these rallies, especially when there were primaries in New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut. Would have loved to have just found a high spot somewhere on the bleachers and watched through a magnifying glass how everything works. I think he's quite a student of stagecraft and presidential advance. His brand is incredibly consistent. You've never seen him, maybe with that exception down in El Paso when he was wearing, a white shirt and khakis to visit the border, much out of his trademark blue suit, a different tie from time to time. And so his brand is incredibly consistent. When you look at him at any of these speeches, take a look at his podium. His podium is a different has a different message created for him every night, where he is geographically and the message that he's trying to say. So that the Lansing, Michigan video looks different than the New York City video or the Jacksonville, Florida video. He understands one of these great lessons of advance work, which is, please, don't make everything look exactly the same, or the watcher watching at home won't have the context to know that you're spending your time traveling the country, going to small cities and towns, and meeting new and different people. If things look exactly the same, people will say, oh, that's just that recast footage from the event last week.
It does seem that Donald Trump routinely says and does things that have derailed or ended campaigns by more traditional candidates. And your book is rife with examples.
Yeah.
Why do the things that Trump says not seem to change anyone's opinion of him?
Well, he has flooded the market with them. And I think with the constant daily barrage of them, many people who are not yet asked to vote in a Republican primary or caucus through the season may be desensitized to them. We haven't been put on the spot yet about whether so many things that he's said about Mexicans, about women, about veterans, and specifically John McCain, any of these incendiary comments that would tend to make a certain part of the voting public that he will need in November to turn them off, they haven't been put to the test yet. And so there's so much of it out there, Chris, that we tend to lump it all together as saying, well, he's coarse and he's vulgar, and I'm not going to vote for him. And yet, if he just modifies a little bit the way he has the last few weeks, the way he did after winning the Indiana primary at Trump Tower, it's not necessarily us, the viewer, who immediately change our mind, but the media, the collective media punditry will say, oh, he's becoming presidential. He's softening his tone. In truth, Donald Trump, who has had 15 seasons on The Apprentice, has won his fame and fortune by working with union people, by working with people of different sexual orientations. And I think, and if you look at his family and some of the things that he's said in his past, he's probably at heart a pretty moderate and central guy and centrist guy. And the question that we'll all answer this summer and fall is, has he said too much from June 2015 to the present to make people change their minds? Will the media be complicit in allowing him to pivot and almost obliviating the things that he said so far, or will he be constantly held to account? We don't know. We're walking into uncharted territory.
Does it matter to American voters what politicians say or only what they do?
Well, the long historical record, of course, is what they say and what they write and what they sign. What the impressions that people form of any person in public, unfortunately, is that what they do becomes this filler material for the evening news and primetime cable and morning news. So that moment that we talked about earlier about President Obama declining to put on the football helmet, it was funny, and therefore it made NBC nightly news. Heidi Cruz accidentally getting elbowed by her husband on the podium in Indiana after the Indiana primary is funny. It becomes a gif on social media. A morning show news producer says, I need to keep people's eyeballs glued to the TV. Therefore, let's play this. Even on a night when a guy who's worked his heart out to try and win the trust of the voters has to declare that he's suspending his campaign, let's instead run this goofy picture of him turning and accidentally brushing his wife's nose with his elbow. It's ridiculous, but it's the world we live in, Chris.
You've described the years of the Obama administration as the vanilla presidency. Why?
Well, because I think President Obama has long shown himself to be a student of the age of optics and a careful treader in public with his image for many reasons, many legitimate reasons. I think if you looked back in 2008, 2009, and you Googled Barack Obama, you'd see all sorts of imagery, photoshopped imagery that made him look ghoulish, played on his race, did any matter of negative metaphor that if you were the father of young girls, you would never want to play into. So if he discovered as a law professor and a great writer in the campaign of 2008 and coming into the White House in 2009, that if he has a speechwriter like Jon Favreau and he himself as a great editor, why not make every word, every paragraph perfect, put it up on the teleprompter, and in that way, and wear a blue suit, speak in front of a blue curtain, don't test the limits of the presidency as his predecessors have, and play it completely safe. And I have an example of when I sort of came briefly out of retirement to serve as the lead advance person for a trip that he made to Trinidad and Tobago, in which I tried to do what I would do with Bill Clinton all the time. Hey, man, let's have some fun. Let's go out to a cricket field with Brian Lara, a world-class cricketer. Let him show you how to bat and for like 15 minutes get out of the humdrum of the summit inside the Hyatt Regency where all you saw was pipe and drape. And I tried to convince everyone in the Obama White House, that this is early 2009, that, hey, this is what I did with Bill Clinton all the time. And we created great pictures, and we got front page treatment. And in some ways, I let the president have an enjoyable experience with this job that he had and made people appreciate that he appreciated these opportunities. There was no way that President Obama or his staff were going to buy into my idea. And I think that prevailed pretty much for a good part of his first term, using the White House photographer very strategically to take the images that they wanted to project, releasing them in public through Flickr and Instagram and Twitter, and in the process denying access to a lot of the working photographers who were just trying to get a picture of the president doing their job on a daily basis. So it's created great tensions between the White House staff, the president, and the press corps about journalistic access.
We're just weeks out from the conventions. What can we at home look for that is likely the work of an advance team?
Well, we were going to see a very interesting dynamic play out with a contested convention if Senator Cruz or Governor Kasich was able to get more traction in these later primaries. But what really to look for is the pacing and design of what happens in prime time in both Philadelphia and Cleveland for these two conventions. Now, there's not going to be the drama probably that we thought there might be. Networks will probably stick with their primetime programming, deferring to their cable channels to cover gavel to go to gavel-to-gavel coverage. But look at the lighting. Look at the colors designed on the stage. Look at how look at the selection of speakers and how everyone is on the same message. Look at how the videos are interspersed to keep people's attention in the room. And look at how the production sort of controls the crowd. I talk about this scene in 1988. Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas has the esteemed opportunity to put Governor Dukakis's name in nomination. And he gives the nomination speech. And for an up-and-coming politician like Bill Clinton, it was a great opportunity. But Clinton, as is his nature, went long. And the producers decided not to keep the lights in the Omni Arena in Atlanta low, which would have restricted the network's ability to cut away and to show delegates sort of talking amongst themselves or waving their placards or hissing or booing. And instead, there was this outcry of people who wanted Governor Clinton to stop his speech. Not really, but when Governor Clinton said, in conclusion, there were cheers in the Omni. And this could have been prevented, I argue, with some better production techniques in the Omni. And later, Governor Clinton had to go on the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show, and sort of show that he was a more disciplined person than that. Carson puts a hourglass on the table to show that Governor Clinton only has a few minutes to answer this question.
We just have about 30 seconds left. In the event that Hillary Clinton were to be elected president, what kind of strategy would her advance team need to employ to build her image? Could she be fun like you helped to demonstrate about Bill Clinton?
I think Secretary Clinton is a very fun person. I think she relishes policy. She relishes governing. She relishes issues and creating relationships with foreign leaders. Do I think that she would at 69 or 70 years old or 69 years old when she would be taking the oath of office be the same type of person that Bill Clinton was at 47 when he wanted to do so much, had so much energy, wanted to keep shaking hands until midnight? I don't think that's her. I don't think that's who she would be. But I think she'd be a terrific president if she got elected.
Josh King is former director of production for presidential events and author of the book Off Script, An Advance Man's Guide to White House Stagecraft, Campaign Spectacle, and Political Suicide. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is our associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.